Hey, it's Otis here. Before we get to the bedtime reading, I wanted to let you know that I just launched a brand new show. It's called The Daily Book Club, a daytime companion to Sleepy, where you hear entire books one chapter at a time, one day at a time. Simple as that. So if Sleepy is how you wind down your day, The Daily Book Club is a great way to start your day. There's new episodes daily. I read in a slightly peppier voice so that you can get really lost in these amazing stories that have stood the test of time. Or, just like Sleepy, you can sit back and relax and zone out to a good book. The first book we'll be reading is The Enchanted April by Elizabeth Von Arnim. Story is, in the 1920s, four women unfulfilled with life take a chance and abscond to a dreamy medieval Italian castle. It's a story dripping with wisteria, the beauty of solitude, and an unlikely pursuit of joy in Portofino, Italy. I think that this is a perfect story for the season, and you can hear it now. Find the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. This show has been a long time coming, and I'm so excited to bring you even more stories. So go subscribe to the Daily Book Club to hear what happens next. Thanks. This episode of Sleepy is proudly sponsored by ButcherBox. If you've listened to Sleepy for a while, you know that I love good food, eating well, and treating my body right so that I can take on my days. Well, ButcherBox helps you do exactly that. They deliver super high quality, 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, crate-free pork, and wild-caught seafood right to your door. It's humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. They have a huge variety to choose from. They are excellent deals. They've got recipes and guides and tips included, and there's free shipping, always. Eating well is a huge factor in getting a good night's sleep, as is sometimes saving the trip to the grocery store and taking some stress out of your daily schedule. I have been loving these deliveries for those reasons. Been cooking up their steak tips with eggs in the morning, with butter and scallions and soy sauce, and I also made a delicious brine chicken roast with lemon parsley gravy. So good. The prices for this kind of quality and convenience is really impressive. ButcherBox has made me very happy. So sign up at butcherbox.com/sleepy and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. Choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/sleepy and use code SLEEPY to choose your free for a year offer. Plus, get $20 off your first order. butcherbox.com/sleepy. Eat well, sleep well.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, and you're listening to Sleepy. A podcast where I read old books to help you get to sleep, and a proud member of the Airwave Podcast Network. I have got a wonderful, snoozy bedtime story for you tonight. But before we get to tonight's reading, I just want to thank all of our patrons on Patreon.com. Hannah Jones, Malvika Kadia, Mary Devitt, Mustakir Muhammad, Brittany Barnes, and Jake and Jess Brush, who are getting married on June 5th. So, thank you very much, Jake and Jess, and congratulations. Thank you all so much for being a part of making this show. And for anyone who doesn't know, all of these wonderful names that I just read are brand new patrons on Patreon.com, where you can go and support Sleepy if it helps you get a better night's sleep and wake up more refreshed the next day. Even donating a dollar goes a really long way. And at $5, there's really cool perks. But no matter how much you donate, I'll read your name in the opening credits of the next show after you do. So if you would like to be a part of making this show, go to patreon.com/sleepyradio. Thank you. And as always, the music you're hearing is by my good friend James Lepkowski, and the cover art for Sleepy is by Gracie Kanan. Tonight, I'm going to be reading from a collection of stories from, I think, my favorite author that I've been reading on this show, other than Nathaniel Hawthorne, and that is the work of Edith Nesbit. Her stories are just so whimsical and fantastical, and they sound really great when you read them out loud. So tonight, I'm going to be reading from her collection, The Story of the Amulet, starting with the chapter, The Samiad, which is a wonderful little tale. I look forward to continuing to read a lot of Edith Nesbit on the show, because I've heard from a lot of you that you love her work as well. So tonight, readings from The Story of the Amulet by Edith Nesbit. And now is the time for you to fluff up your pillow just how you like it. Feel yourself melt into your bed. Get real comfortable. Close your eyes. And let me read to you. Chapter 1, The Samiad. There were once four children who spent their summer holidays in a white house, happily situated between a sandpit and a chalk pit. One day they had the good fortune to find in the sandpit a strange creature. Its eyes were on long horns like snails' eyes, and it could move them in and out like telescopes. It had ears like a bat's ears, and its tubby body was shaped like a spider's and covered with thick, soft fur, and it had hands and feet like a monkey's. It told the children, whose names were Cyril, Robert, Anthea, and Jane, that it was a Samiad, or Sand Fairy. It was old, 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 and its birthday was almost at the very beginning of everything. And it had been buried in the sand for thousands of years. But it still kept its fairy likeness. And part of this fairy likeness was its power to give people whatever they wished for. You know, fairies have always been able to do this. Cyril, Robert, and Thea, and Jane now found their wishes come true. But somehow, they never could think of just the right things to wish for. And their wishes sometimes turned out very oddly indeed. In the end, their unwise wishings landed them in what Robert called a very tight place indeed, and the Samiad consented to help them out of it in return for their promise never, never to ask it to grant them any more wishes, and never tell anyone about it, because it did not want to be bothered to give wishes to anyone ever anymore. At the moment of parting, Jane said politely, "I wish we were going to see you again someday." And the Samiad, touched by this friendly thought, granted the wish. The book about all this is called Five Children in It, and it ends up in a most tiresome way by saying the children did see the Samiad again. But it was not in the sandpit. It was, but I must say no more. The reason that nothing more could be said was that, I had not then been able to find out exactly when and where the children met the Samiad again. Of course, I knew they would meet it, because it was always a beast of its word, and when it said a thing would happen, that thing happened, without fail. How different from the people who tell us about what weather it is going to be on Thursday next, in London, the South Coast, and Channel. The summer holidays, during which the Samiad had been found, and the wishes given, have been wonderful holidays in the country, and the children had the highest hopes of just such another holiday for the next summer. The winter holidays were beguiled by the wonderful happenings of the phoenix and the carpet, and the loss of these two treasures would have left the children in despair, but for the splendid hope of their next holiday in the country. The world, they felt, and indeed had some reason to feel, was full of wonderful things, and they were really the sort of people that wonderful things happened to. So they looked forward to the summer holiday, and when it came, everything was different, and very, very horrid. Father had to go out to Manchuria to telegraph news about the war to the tiresome paper he wrote for, the Daily Bellower, or something like that was its name. And Mother, poor dear Mother, was away in Madeira because she had been very ill. And the lamb, baby, was with her. And Aunt Emma, who was Mother's sister, had suddenly married Uncle Reginald, who was Father's brother, and they had gone to China, which is much too far off for you to expect to be asked to spend the holidays in, however fond your aunt and uncle may be of you. So the children were left in the care of old nurse, who lived in Fitzroy Street, near the British Museum, and though she was always very kind to them, and indeed spoiled them far more than would be good for the most grown-up of us, the four children felt perfectly wretched, and when the cab had driven off with Father and all his boxes and guns and the sheepskin with the blankets and the aluminum mess kit inside it, the stoutest heart quailed, and the girls broke down altogether and sobbed in each other's arms, while the boys each looked out of one of the long, gloomy windows of the parlor and tried to pretend that no boy could be such a muff as to cry. I hope you noticed that they were not cowardly enough to cry till their father had gone. They knew he had quite enough to upset him without that. But when he was gone, everyone felt as if it had been trying not to cry all its life, and that it must cry now if it died for it. So they cried. Tea, with shrimps and watercress, cheered them a little. The watercress was arranged in a hedge round a fat glass salt cellar, a tasteful device they had never seen before. But it was not a cheerful meal. After tea, Anthea went up to the room that had been Father's, and when she saw how dreadfully he wasn't there, and remembered how every minute was taking him further and further from her, and nearer to the guns of the Russians, she cried a little more. Then she thought of Mother, ill and alone, and perhaps at that very moment, wanting a little girl to put eau de cologne on her head, make her sudden cups of tea, and she cried more than ever. And then she remembered what Mother had said the night before she went away about Anthea being the eldest girl and about trying to make the others happy and things like that. So she stopped crying and thought instead. And when she had thought as long as she could possibly bear, she washed her face and combed her hair and went down to the others. trying her best to look as though crying were an exercise she had never even heard of. She found the parlor in deepest gloom, hardly relieved at all by the efforts of Robert, who, to make the time pass, was pulling Jane's hair, not hard, but just enough to tease. "Look here," said Anthea. "Let's have a palaver." This word dated from the awful day that Cyril had carelessly wished that there were Indians in England, and there had been. The word brought back memories of last summer holidays, and everyone groaned. They thought of the white house with the beautiful tangled garden, late roses, asters, marigold, sweet mignonette, and feathery asparagus, of the wilderness which someone had once meant to make into an orchard, but which was now, as Father said, 5 acres of thistles haunted by the ghosts of baby cherry trees. They thought of the view across the valley, where the lime kilns looked like Aladdin's palaces in the sunshine, and they thought of their own sandpit, with its fringe of yellowy grasses and pale, stringy-stalked wildflowers, and the little holes in the cliff that were the little San Martins' little front doors. And they thought of the free, fresh air smelling of thyme and sweetbriar, and the scent of the wood smoke from the cottages in the lane, and they looked round old nurse's stuffy parlor, and Jane said, "Oh, how different it all is." It was. Old nurse had been in the habit of letting lodgings till Father gave her the children to take care of, and her rooms were furnished for letting. Now, it is a very odd thing that no one ever seems to furnish a room for letting in a bit the same way as one would furnish it for living in. This room had heavy, dark red stuff curtains, the color that blood would not make a stain on, with coarse lace curtains inside. The carpet was yellow and violet, with bits of gray and brown oilcloth in odd places. The fireplace had shavings and tinsel in it. There was a very varnished mahogany chiffonier, or sideboard with a lock that wouldn't act. There were hard chairs, far too many of them, with crochet antimacassars slipping off their seats, all of which sloped the wrong way. The table wore a cloth of a cruel green color, with a yellow chain stitch pattern round it. Over the fireplace was a looking glass that made you look much uglier than you really were, however plain you might be to begin with. Then there was a mantel bar with maroon plush and wool fringe that did not match the plush, a dreary clock like a black marble tomb. It was silent as a grave, too, for it had long since forgotten how to tick. And there were painted glass vases that never had any flowers in them, and a painted tambourine that no one ever played, and painted brackets with nothing on them, and maple-framed engravings of the Queen, the Houses of Parliament, the Plains of Heaven, and of a blunt-nosed woodsman's flat return. There were 2 books, last December's Bradshaw, and an odd volume of Plume Ridge's Commentary on Thessalonians. There were, but I cannot dwell longer on this very painful picture. It was indeed, as Jane said, very different. "Let's have a palaver," said Anthea again. "What about?" said Cyril, yawning. "There's nothing to have anything about," said Robert, kicking the leg of the table miserably. "I don't want to play," said Jane, and her tone was grumpy. And Thea tried very hard not to be cross. She succeeded. "Look here," she said. "Don't think I want to be preachy or a beast in any way. But I want to what Father calls define the situation. Do you agree?" "Fire ahead," said Cyril, without enthusiasm. "Well then, we all know the reason we're staying here is because Nurse couldn't leave her house on account of the poor learned gentleman on the top floor. And there was no one else Father could entrust to take care of us. And you know it's taken a lot of money, Mother's going to Madeira to be made well." Jane sniffed miserably. "Yes, I know," said Anthea in a hurry. "But don't let's think about how horrid it all is. I mean, we can't go do things that cost a lot, but we must do something. And I know there are heaps of things you can see in London without paying for them. And I thought we'd go and see them. We are all quite old now, and we haven't got the lamp." Jane sniffed harder than before. "I mean, no one can say no because of him, dear Pat. And I thought we must get Nurse to see how quite old we are, and let us go out by ourselves, or else we shall never have any sort of a time at all. And I vote we see everything there is. And let's begin by asking Nurse to give us some bits of bread, and we'll go to St. James's Park. There are ducks there, I know. We can feed them. Only we must make Nurse let us go by ourselves." "Hurrah for liberty," said Robert. "But she won't." "Yes, she will," said Jane unexpectedly. "I thought about that this morning, and I asked Father, and he said yes. And what's more, he told old Nurse we might. Only he said we must always say where we wanted to go, and if it was right, she would let us." "Three cheers for thoughtful Jane," cried Cyril, now roused at last from his yawning despair. "I say, let's go now." So they went out, old Nurse only begging them to be careful of crossings and to ask a policeman to assist in more difficult cases. But they were used to crossings, for they had lived in Camden Town and knew the Kentish Town Road, where the trams rush up and down like mad at all hours of the day and night, and seem as though, if anything, they would rather run over you than not. They had promised to be home by dark, but it was July, so dark would be very late indeed, and long past bedtime. They started to walk to St. James's Park, and all their pockets were stuffed with bits of bread and the crusts of toast to feed the ducks with. They started, I repeat, but they never got there. Between Fitzroy Street and St. James's Park, there were a great many streets. If you go the right way, you will pass a great many shops that you cannot possibly help stopping to look at. The children stopped to look at several with gold lace and beads and pictures and jewelry and dresses and hats and oysters and lobsters in their windows. And their sorrow did not seem nearly so impossible to bear as it had done in the best parlor at number 300 Fitzroy Street. Presently, by some wonderful chance turn of Robert's, who had been voted captain because the girls thought it would be good for him, and indeed he thought so himself, and of course Cyril couldn't vote against him because it would have looked like a mean jealousy, came into the little interesting criss-crossy streets that held the most interesting shops of all, the shops where live things were sold. There was one shop window, entirely filled with cages and all sorts of beautiful birds in them. The children were delighted till they remembered how they had once wished for wings themselves and had had them, and then they felt how desperately unhappy anything with wings must be if it is shut up in a cage and not allowed to fly. "It must be fairly beastly to be a bird in a cage," said Cyril. "Come on." They went on, and Cyril tried to think out a scheme for making his fortune as a gold digger at Klondike, and then buying all the caged birds in the world and setting them free. Then they came to a shop that sold cats, but the cats were in cages, and the children could not help wishing someone would buy all the cats and put them on the hearth rugs, which are the proper places for cats. And there was the dog shop, and that was not a happy thing to look at either, because all the dogs were chained or caged, and all the dogs, big and little, looked at the four children with sad, wistful eyes and wagged beseeching tails as if they were trying to say, "Buy me, buy me, buy me, and let me go for a walk with you. Oh, do buy me, and buy my poor brothers too. Do, do, do." They almost said, "Do, do, do," plain to the ear, as they whined. All but one big Irish terrier, and he growled when Jane patted him. "Grr," he seemed to say, as he looked at them from the back corner of his eye, "you won't buy me. Nobody will, ever. I shall die chained up. And I don't know that I care how soon it is either. I don't know that the children would have understood all this. Only once they had been in a besieged castle, so they knew how hateful it is to be kept in when you want to get out. Of course, they could not buy any of the dogs. They did indeed ask for the price of the very, very smallest, and it was 65 pounds. But that was because it was a Japanese toy spaniel, like the queen once had her portrait painted with when she was only Princess of Wales. But the children thought, if the smallest was all that money, the biggest would run into thousands. So they went on. And they did not stop at any more cat or dog or bird shops, but passed them by. And at last they came to a shop that seemed as though it only sold creatures that did not much mind where they were, such as goldfish and white mice and sea anemones and other aquarium beasts, and lizards and toads and hedgehogs and tortoises and tame rabbits and guinea pigs. And there they stopped for a long time and fed the guinea pigs with bits of bread through the cage bars and wondered whether it would be possible to keep a sandy color double up in the basement of the house in Fitzroy Street. "I don't suppose old nurse would mind very much," said Jane. "Rabbits are most awfully tame sometimes. I expect it would know her voice and follow her all about. She'd tumble over 20 times a day," said Cyril. "Now, a snake." "There aren't any snakes," said Robert hastily. "And besides, I never could cotton to snakes somehow. I wonder why." "Worms are as bad," said Anthea, "and eels and slugs. I think it's because we don't like things that haven't got legs." "Father says snakes have got legs hidden away inside of them," said Robert. "Yes, and he says we've got tails hidden away inside us. But it doesn't either of it come to anything, really," said Anthea. "I hate things that haven't got legs." "It's worse when they have too many," said Jane with a shudder. "Think of centipedes." They stood there on the pavement, a cause of some inconvenience to the passers-by, and thus beguiled the time with conversation. Cyril was leaning his elbow on the top of a hutch that had seemed empty when they had inspected the whole edifice of hutches one by one, and he was trying to reawaken the interest of a hedgehog that had curled itself into a ball earlier in the interview, when a small, soft voice just below his elbow said quietly, plainly, and quite unmistakably, not in any squeak or whine that had to be translated, but in downright common English, "Buy me. Do. Please buy me." Cyril started as though he had been pinched and jumped a yard away from the hutch. "Come back. Oh, come back," said the voice, rather louder, but still softly. "Stoop down and pretend to be tying up your bootlace. I see it's undone, as usual." Cyril mechanically obeyed. He knelt on one knee on the dry, hot, dusty pavement, peered into the darkness of the hutch, and found himself face to face with the Samiad. It seemed much thinner than when they had last seen it. It was dusty and dirty, and its fur was untidy and ragged. It had hunched itself up into a miserable lump, and its long snail eyes were drawn in quite tight so that they hardly showed at all. "Listen," said the Samiad, in a voice that sounded as though it would begin to cry in a minute. "I don't think the creature who keeps this shop will ask a very high price for me. I've bitten him more than once, and I've made myself look as common as I can. He's never had a glance from my beautiful, beautiful eyes. Tell the others I'm here, but tell them to look at some of those low, common beasts while I'm talking to you. The creature inside mustn't think you care much about me, or he'll put a price upon me far, far beyond your means. I remember in the dear old days last summer, you never had much money. Oh, I never thought I should be so glad to see you. I never did." It sniffed and shot out its long snail's eyes expressly to drop a tear well away from its fur. "Tell the others I'm here, and then I'll tell you exactly what to do about buying me." Cyril tied his bootlace into a hard knot, stood up and addressed the others in firm tones. "Look here," he said, "I'm not kidding, and I appeal to your honor, an appeal which in this family was never made in vain. Don't look at that hutch. Look at that white rat. Now you are not to look at that hutch, whatever I say." He stood in front of it to prevent mistakes. "Now get yourselves ready for a great surprise. In that hutch, there's an old friend of ours. Don't look. Yes, it's a Samiad, the good old Samiad. It wants us to buy it. It says you're not to look at it. Look at the white rat and count your money. On your honor, don't look." The others responded nobly. They looked at the white rat till they quite stared him out of countenance, so that he went and sat up on his hind legs in a far corner and hid his eyes with his front paws and pretended he was washing his face. Cyril stooped again, busying himself with the other bootlace, and listened for the Samiad's further instructions. "Go in," said the Samiad, "and ask the price of lots of other things. Then say, what do you want for that monkey that's lost its tail? The mangy old thing in the third hutch from the end." "Oh, don't mind my feelings. Call me a mangy monkey. I've tried hard enough to look like one. I don't think he'll put a high price on me. I've bitten him 11 times since I came here the day before yesterday. If he names a bigger price than you can afford, Say you wish you had the money. But you can't give us wishes. I promise never to have another wish from you, said the bewildered Cyril. Don't be a silly little idiot, said the Sand Fairy in trembling but affectionate tones, but find out how much money you've got between you and do exactly what I tell you. Cyril, pointing a stiff and unmeaning finger at the white rat, so as to pretend that its charms alone employed his tongue, explained matters to the others, while the Samiad hunched itself and bunched itself and did its very best to make itself look uninteresting. Then the four children filed into the shop. How much do you want for that white rat? Asked Cyril. 8 pence was the answer. And the guinea pigs? 8 pence to 5 bob, according to the breed. And the lizards? 9 pence each. And toads? 4 pence. Now look here, said the greasy owner of all this caged life, with a sudden ferocity which made the whole party back hurriedly onto the wainscoting of hutches with which the shop was lined. Looky here. I ain't a-going to have you a-coming in here, a-turning the whole place outer-winder, and prizing every animal in this stock just for your larks. So don't think of it. If you're a buyer, be a buyer. But I never had a customer yet that's wanted to buy mice and lizards and toads and guineas all at once. So how he goes. Oh, wait a minute, said the wretched Cyril, feeling how foolishly, yet well-meaningly, he had carried out the Samiad's instructions. Just tell me one thing. What do you want for the mangy old monkey in the third hutch from the end? The shopman only saw in this a new insult. Mangy young monkey yourself, said he. Get along with your blooming cheek. Out you goes. Oh, don't be so cross, said Jane, losing her head altogether. Don't you see he really does want to know that? Oh, does he indeed, sneered the merchant. Then he scratched his ear suspiciously, for he was a sharp businessman, and he knew the ring of truth when he heard it. His hand was bandaged, and 3 minutes before, he would have been glad to sell the mangy old monkey for 10 shillings. Now. Oh, he does he? He said. Then 2 pun-tenths, my price. He's not got his fellow, that monkey, eh? Nor yet his match. Nor this side of the equator which he comes from. And the only one ever seen in London. Ought to be in a zoo. 2 pun-ten. Down in the nail, or out you goes. The children looked at each other. 23 shillings and 5 pence was all they had in the world, and it would have been merely 3 and 5 pence, but for the sovereign which father had given to them between them at parting. We've only 23 shillings and 5 pence, said Cyril, rattling the money in his pocket. 23 farthings and somebody's own cheek, said the dealer, for he did not believe that Cyril had so much money. There was a miserable pause. Then Anthea remembered and said, Oh, I wish I had 2 pounds 10. So do I, miss, I'm sure, said the man with bitter politeness. I wish you had, I'm sure. Anthea's hand was on the counter. Something seemed to slide under it. She lifted it. There lay 5 bright half-sovereigns. Why, I have got it after all, she said. Here's the money. Now let's have the monkey. The dealer looked hard at the money, but he made haste to put it in his pocket. I only hope you come by it honest, he said, shrugging his shoulders. He scratched his ear again. "Well," he said, "I suppose I must let you have it, but it's worth triple the money, so it is." He slowly led the way out to the hutch, opened the door gingerly, and made a sudden, fierce grab at the Samoyed, which the Samoyed acknowledged in one last, long, lingering bite. "Here, take the brew," said the shopman, squeezing the Samoyed so tight that he nearly choked it. "It's bit me to the marrow, yeah." The man's eyes opened as Anthea held out her arms. "Don't blame me if it tears your face off its bones," he said. And the Samoyed made a leap from his dirty, horny hands, and Anthea caught it in hers, which were not very clean, certainly, but at any rate were soft and pink, and held it kindly and closely. "But you can't take it home like that," Cyril said. "We shall have a crowd after us." And indeed, two errand boys and a policeman had already collected. "I can't give you nothing, only a paper bag, like what we put the tortoises in," said the man grudgingly. So the whole party went into the shop, and the shopman's eyes nearly came out of his head when, having given Anthea the largest paper bag he could find, he saw her hold it open, and the Samoyed carefully creep into it. "Well," he said, "if that there don't be cockfighting. But perhaps you've met the brute before." "Yes," said Cyril, affably. "He's an old friend of ours." "If I'd have known that," the man rejoined, "you shouldn't have had him under twice the money. However," he added, as the children disappeared, "I ain't done so bad, seeing as I only give 5 bob for the beast. But then there's the bites to take into account." The children, trembling in agitation and excitement, carried home the Samoyed, trembling in its paper bag. When they got it home, Anthea nursed it and stroked it and would have cried over it if she hadn't remembered how it hated to be wet. When it recovered enough to speak, it said, "Give me sand, silver sand from the oil and color shop, and get me plenty." They got the sand, and they put it and the Samoyed in the round bath together, and it rubbed itself, and rolled itself, and shook itself, and scraped itself, and scratched itself, and preened itself, till it felt clean and comfy, and then it scrabbled a hasty hole in the sand, and went to sleep in it. The children hid the bath under the girl's bed, and had supper. Old nurse had got them a lovely supper of bread and butter and fried onions. She was full of kind and delicate thoughts. When Anthea woke the next morning, the Samoyed was snuggling down between her shoulder and Jane's. "You have saved my life," it said. "I know that man would have thrown cold water on me sooner or later, and then I should have died. I saw him wash out a guinea pig's hutch yesterday morning. I'm still frightfully sleepy. I think I'll go back to sand for another nap. Wake the boys and this dormouse of a Jane, and when you've had your breakfast, we'll have a talk." "Don't you want any breakfast?" asked Anthea. "I dare say. I shall pick a bit presently," it said. "But sand is all I care about. It's meat to drink to me, and coals and fire and wife and children." With these words, it clambered down by the bedclothes and scrambled back into the bath, where they heard it scratching itself out of sight. "Well," said Anthea, "anyhow, our holidays won't be dull now. We found the Samoyed again. No, said Jane, beginning to put on her stockings. We shan't be dull. But it'll be only like having a pet dog. Now it can't give us wishes. Oh, don't be so discontented, said Anthea. If it can't do anything else, it can tell us about megatheriums and things. Thank you for listening to Sleepy. Good night.